You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Well, welcome back to the HeadX studio, everybody. And I'm joined for today's episodes with as a co-host by Christy Collis of AIPC and of Herdsa.
Thank you very much, Martin. It's a delight to be back on HeadX. It's always an honor and a privilege to get to be here.
Well, it's always great to interact with you on a whole range of things. And I'm glad we're doing this, the first of a number of episodes that we might do together in 2024, Christy. I know you've got some exciting other guests in your mind to bring to us, and I'll I won't preempt it by them not having had the chance to accept an invitation first, but I look forward to us both revealing more about those down the track. And look, we're also going to be working together with the guests that we have today at the forthcoming HeadX conference on the 21st of March in Melbourne. Thank you so much for joining us on stage again for the event in Melbourne in a few weeks' time.
Oh, they're always a really powerful and stimulating event, your HeadX conferences. So again, I'm really honored to get to be involved again. I'm particularly keen to hear from our guest today, who will also be at the HeadX conference on 21st May by live stream. So today we're going to get a chance to really do a deep dive into one of the presenters who we'll meet again at the conference.
Gosh, you're almost doing a drum roll for us there, Christy. It's a lovely teaser for a forthcoming conference. And look, we'll get to announcing who he is very shortly, but perhaps we ought to say a little bit about why we've chosen him and why it's important that we've chosen someone like him for the onward journey of HeadX, particularly from my point of view of where HeadX is up to and where we're up to and what the future looks like. And that I've been so pleased that we've built through partnerships with people like yourself, through universities around Australia, through tech companies, through different public bodies, such a groundswell of work about Australia and in Australia. But it increasingly occurs to me that the issues that we're dealing with are so similar to the issues of change in higher education happening in Europe, in North America, in Asia, in all other parts of the world. And therefore, to try and get more guests and more of our audience to participate from other parts of the world by addressing the generic issues of culture and equity and leadership and innovation as they occur in all parts of the world, to me, seems like a really important step in what HeadX will be doing in 2024.
It does. So HeadX is really, yeah, as you said, determining some of the commonalities in higher education across the globe, but also looking at what are the distinctions between different forms of higher education in different areas. So yeah, this represents a really logical next step for HeadX. And it's going to be useful for listeners, not only in learning about higher education in another context, but also because hearing about higher education in a different context than our own is often really useful for refracting your thinking about what you're doing about higher education itself. So I think for HeadX to be taking on international guests is particularly useful.
Refracting your thinking. What a lovely expression. I wish I'd thought of that one, but I'll try to remember attribute it as I'm bound to use it going forward. But look, Christy, that's a lovely way of introducing the rationale together for today's guest. I better tell everybody who it is, given it's someone that I've known so long. His name is Professor Ghassan Awad. He's the Chancellor of Abu Dhabi University, a private university in the United Arab Emirates. I knew him from us working 10 years together in the UK, what now seems like an awfully long time ago. I've kept in touch with him ever since, but quite remotely. And to learn of his journey to be leading one of the fastest growing private universities in one of the most dynamic, challenging and complex parts of the world right now, with so much going on and so much that we're all looking at and interested in, makes him a perfect guest for today. Is that a good introduction from your point of view of what we're about to hear?
Absolutely. And I think the last thing that listeners might want to consider is when we're hearing about United Arab Emirates today, what's particularly useful for us to consider for who don't live in the Middle East is that United Arab Emirates has a very high concentration of transnational education operations, including our guest today worked at, I believe, University of Wollongong in Dubai. So what we're going to hear about is not simply a foreign context of higher education, but also a context in which many of us may find ourselves working going forward as the transnational education expansion continues.
Well, lovely point to make, Christy. And let's hear more from Ghassan and what he had to say about his story and what his lessons have been from a lifetime of leading disciplines and leading institutions in Europe and now the Middle East. Straight after this message from our sponsor. Our guest today on HEDX is Professor Ghassan Awad. And Ghassan is the Chancellor of Abu Dhabi University in the United Arab Emirates. He's formerly the president of the Applied Science University in Bahrain and also of the University of Wollongong in Dubai. So a variety of experiences across the Middle East. But he had prior experience that began after a PhD gained at Loughborough University in the UK, following which he spent 20 years at the University of Salford, a university that I knew well and where we worked together for 10 years. His roles in Salford included being the Pro Vice Chancellor for Research and Innovation, the Dean of the College of Science and Technology, the Dean of the Faculty of Business, Law and the Built Environment, the Director of the Research Institute of the Built and Human Environment, and like me, the Head of the School of Construction and Property Management, which for both of us we've seen now become the School of the Built Environment. He's past president of a very large and prestigious professional body called the Chartered Institute of Building, which is more than 180 years old and has more than 45,000 members from across the globe, including me. Ghassan, welcome to HEDX.
Thank you so much, Martin. Pleasure to be on HEDX.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to watch and see your rise through all those roles at Salford, through all of those places, through the Middle East, through that role in CIOB, which was the first professional body I joined. And now to be in this role of Chancellor of Abu Dhabi University in the United Arab Emirates, a university that's risen so quickly, really in the 12 months or more that you've been there, to such a prestigious position in the local and now the global scene. But let's come to that in a little while. I wonder if we might start the story with where your story started, because Ghassan, even though we worked together for 10 years at Salford and we were very close, I can remember you telling me some stories about your upbringing in Lebanon. I'm not sure I can remember everything about where you were born, where you grew up, and what your story has been in life that set you on the path to and gave you the foundations to progress to be a global leader of universities and of the professions that you are now. Tell us a little bit about your personal story and journey to today.
Yeah, before I start, Martin, I'd like to thank you first. And we go a long way and we work together and you are my boss. So you have contributed immensely to where I am now. And this is reality. I should say that at the very, very beginning. Now, my story starts in Lebanon, where I was born in a small village called Anout. It's about 4,000 people, population 800 meters above sea level. It's a beautiful village, plenty of olive trees and water springs, and the rest was a very, very beautiful childhood in a very nice and peaceful place. Then I studied at the local school and for my maybe secondary school, I went to Baqlin Secondary School. Anout is in the Shouf Mountains, it's in the mountains of Lebanon, in fact, in an area called Shouf. And for my undergraduate, I studied as for Bachelor in Civil Engineering at Beirut Arab University. And after graduation, I worked for 2 years in the south of Lebanon, building schools sponsored by UNICEF. And of course, unfortunately, the civil war was still raging in Lebanon. So I decided to go to the UK to study for a master's in construction and a PhD in construction management and IT at Loughborough University. This was funded by Hariri Foundation. So if it wasn't for the late Prime Minister of Lebanon, Rafiq Hariri, many of us wouldn't have been able to study for either bachelor, master, or a PhD. He sent around 34,000 students to study mainly abroad in the United Kingdom, Canada, United States, other places, and in Lebanon as well. So I was one of the lucky ones who got the scholarship in order to be able to continue my study for a master's and a PhD.
And when we worked together in England, Ghassan, I knew you, as I find you still now, a very gentle and kind man with a great sense of honour and integrity, and you being widely liked by everyone you met and worked with. But the other thing that I reflect on looking back, and I thought might be interesting for us to explore on this podcast, is that I can remember us going to attend meetings of European Union-funded research projects. We had so much activity on big European Union-funded research projects together from Salford, didn't we? With partners in places like VTT in Finland, CSTB in France. And when we'd turn up to some of those meetings, we'd find the local groups would all be of one culture, say all Finns or all French people. Whereas in our group, I think I can remember once going to a meeting with you and I, with Marjan, an Iranian colleague of ours, and Mustafa, an Iraqi, who were both also professorial colleagues, or at least on their way to becoming so. And even in the meetings themselves, us reflecting with each other and with our international counterparts, how different it was for us to be in those international projects, being able to attend as such a multicultural group and work in such multicultural ways. Is that how you reflect upon your time in Europe, working with the different groups of people you were working with?
Yes, I mean, studying and working in the UK in particular was different, because when we were in Loughborough, I remember doing my master's degree in construction, we had a large group of students from various nationalities, and the course was led by Professor Tony Thorpe, a great man, great friend. I saw him recently in Loughborough. And then when we did our PhD, there was a very large group of international students studying for a PhD. The same happened when I came to Salford in 1992 to work for Professor Peter Brandon, who wanted to create this international community and make Salford one of the best, not in the UK, one of the best in the world. And to a large extent, during these golden years, we have managed to create this image and reputation for our school. I mean, you are heading it, Martin, at some stage. And I remember at some stage when I was director of the Research Institute for the Built and Human Environment, we had about 500 plus PhD students in the school. 90% maybe come from across the globe, from 100 plus nationalities. So this multiculturalism was part of the ethos of the university in Salford. And of course, when we start working on European projects, our European colleagues, to a large extent, it could be because of the language, it could be because some of them are publicly funded institutions. They were not in the form of universities, in fact. But I thought the multinationalism, the cosmopolitan approach to education was dominant in Salford. And in the UK, and this is reality. Now I work in I worked in the Middle East. I work at the University of Hong Kong, Dubai, at Gulf University for Science and Technology in Kuwait, at Applied Science University in Bahrain, and now at Abu Dhabi University. And you see people from across the globe. At Abu Dhabi University, we have faculty and staff from over 43 nationalities. We have students from over 100 nationalities. You can see the multiculturalism, the acceptance of each other. In the UAE, we have a ministry of tolerance and coexistence to encourage a culture where people can coexist, live in harmony, respect each other's religion, traditions, etc. But at the same time, respect the value system in the United Arab Emirates or any place you live in. The same happened in the UK. There are certain values you have to respect and adhere to. But overall, I was very, very lucky to be working with people from across the globe. And when I look at my network on LinkedIn, has people from almost every single nation on Earth. And this makes me very, very happy that we should all, we belong to this world. The world has become a global village. Whatever we do in a particular part of the world, we'll be helping each other and colleagues and from across the globe. So it has been a wonderful experience. And I'm sure you would have cherished it the way I cherished it as well. And it shows what we have done. Of course, it helped me immensely to lead the Chartered Institute of Building, as you mentioned in the introduction. I am so proud of this, I must admit. I was, I think in 2010, maybe around 10, when I became Junior Vice President, Vice President, then Senior Vice President, then President in 2014. And I was inaugurated in Qatar, in fact. And this institute has over maybe around 50,000 members now established in 1834. I was the first ever president from the Middle East or the Muslim world. My number was 111, the 111th president of the CIOB, working in different cultures, different value systems, but has been a very rich experience for me, and it has made me more mature in terms of dealing with cultural social issues and the rest. And we know, Martin, now, when you look at what's happening to this generation, Generation Z, it's completely different from our generation, completely. And I remember our generation, people used to ask you, what's your IQ? So if you have a high IQ, then you are going to succeed in life, which is not true at all now. You may have a very high IQ and you could be a complete failure. So you need an IQ at some level. But now it's all about emotional intelligence, digital intelligence, cultural intelligence, social intelligence, and environmental intelligence. So many intelligence. I identified 20 types of intelligence. So we're dealing with different generations where we have to export them to different cultures, make them aware of the cultural differences in order to be able to survive in the marketplace, whether they work in the UAE, in the Gulf, the Arab region, or beyond.
Well, there you go. You've not only demonstrated intelligence in your discipline, but you've mastered an understanding of what the different intelligences are and demonstrated why it's so important to be having strength in all of them. And and you did that growing up and forming a career in Europe and then starting a young family in Europe. And look, this is about Ghassan as a leader in higher education, but I'm really interested in this episode of the podcast to get under the hood of, through a leading figure like you that I've known so well, the challenges generally for academics in any disciplines to progress in universities anywhere in the world in multicultural settings. And I wonder if you are in a position to share with us, when we knew each other, it was in Manchester, the northwest of England. We had this wonderful multicultural professorial and academic complement, and we had some fantastic local Mancunians who were part of our both academic and our professional staff, who and really finding the grit from that local population with the richness of the thinking and diversity of culture was the other groups that came to it was a really important ingredient in the culture of excellence and integrity we were able to build. But I imagine for you with a young family being in what for them and for you was still a relatively strange part of the world, there would have been a few challenges along the way growing up in the northwest of England in the late 1990s and the early noughties. Are there any challenges there that you'd like to reflect upon and put down to what's further helped you grow your range of intelligence as a person and as a family, perhaps, to have made the steps that you've made more recently?
I'm married with two kids who were born in the UK. They were born in Manchester area. And we had a fantastic time in the Northwest. Living in Manchester was just amazing. It's a true multicultural, cosmopolitan city. Of course, I mean, when you have young kids, of course, they would suffer because you are on the road most of the time, promoting the university, doing your job, and they have been deprived of, and I feel guilty about that. But I've done everything for them as well. And when you are doing this, you are doing it as part of your career, but you are doing it to support your family. So the challenges were mainly by being away more than being able to be integrated into a different society. And the Northwest Manchester, Salford, were very hospitable. They allowed us to be integrated. We respected their value system, they respected ours, and it's all about respect. Once you respect somebody's value system and you tell them these are the values which I can only accept in my culture, and they would respect you and they would support you. And so, as I say, the challenges were not just... with regards to the job, of course, I had to work very, very hard. I remember when I went for my promotion one day and the head of the department said to me, but you're progressing very fast. I said to him, but I come from a foreign background. I have to work very hard in order to compete with my colleagues in the university. He said, no, please take it easy and just enjoy it as well. And once you are obsessed by your job, it becomes like an obsession, unfortunately, which is not good, in fact, because you should strike the right balance between work and life. But because I was so driven, I was so ambitious, I still work day and night. Nothing has changed. It's not like now I work only days. And when you are in the night, when you are in the right setting, and being now in Abu Dhabi, I think a university which only Martin 20 years old, but for the achievement and the support we get from the chairman here, Dr. Ali Dahiri, to make ADU, Abu Dhabi University, one of the best in the region and beyond. And we have a fantastic board of trustees headed by His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Zayed, and deputy president for the board of trustees is His Excellency Sheikh Nahyan Bakan Nahyan. So those are just really important figures, and the name of Abu Dhabi is very big. So we have to do our very best to support the university, take it to different grounds. And so the challenges are different in every single institution. There are different challenges, but to a large extent, they are universal. And I keep telling my colleagues here and our students and our alumni, once you have clear vision, you know what you are doing, and you have the leadership required at all levels. I'm not talking about leader of the vice chancellor or deputy vice chancellor, at all levels. When you have the innovation and you have the passion, you are passionate about what you are doing, and everything is engulfed within quality. So quality is the oxygen you breathe every day. I couldn't imagine anybody would fail when you have these five ingredients. And this is the reality. And when you told me about being kind and nice and the rest, I hope that I'm really nice and kind. I remember Peter Barrett, when I became head of school at Salford, he said to me, please, Ghassan, kind on people, tough on principles and performance. And I learned this from him. And I have been driven by this statement all my life, maybe, which is true. And to a large extent, Peter Brandon was guiding us in that way. Because what happened? People are people. They are humans. You should respect them. You should support them. If they need support, if they need development, you should do it. But you cannot afford to have somebody in the institution who are not performing well after development, after support, because a rotten apple will rot the rest. So people will say, how come this person is getting away with murder and I can't? So we have to be careful in terms of striking the right balance between kindness and performance and achievement. And I think this is very, very important.
Some very wise words there, Ghassan. And look, they're wise words and learnings that you gained in the UK. And after rising to the most senior positions in Salford and making such a great impact in that place after 20 years, in 2012, you and your family moved to the Middle East, first of all to an Australian university, as we've said, with a campus in Dubai, and then to other places. And I wonder how that transition for you and your family from the UK to the Middle East, how did that move come about? What was the experience like for you and your family? And what did you learn in that change of setting?
Of course, it has been a learning experience for us. To start in the UK, being in Salford for 20 years, I started as a research fellow, as you know, then become a lecturer, reader, professor, head of school, director of research institute, dean of faculty, provost chancellor for research and innovation. And I don't think at that time there were many people from ethnic backgrounds who were in very senior academic position. The same applied to women in senior leadership positions in academia in the UK. There were hardly in the early 1990s any female vice chancellor, and there were hardly any ethnic minority pro vice chancellor, not vice chancellor. So to do that and to achieve at that level, it shows the great environment we had at Salford. We had, of course, the golden years. We were part of it, Martin. You know what we have done what we have achieved as a group together, and the respect we have for each other, the support we have. And of course, you come to a different culture. I was heading the University of Hong Kong, Dubai. It was an interesting experience, different from the UK, but I've started to adjust that the value system is different. Even though the value system of the nation as a whole, the UAE, is incredible because it's based around support, innovation, tolerance, coexistence. I mean, the values, I could see them in the West. They're not different at all. And it was a learning experience for me. I understand different value system, different approach to leadership and management. I couldn't take the leadership approach from the West, transport it to the East, and then say one size fits all. It doesn't work at all. So I learned my lessons maybe at the University of Hong Kong, Dubai. And then I went to Kuwait. I was vice president for academic affairs. It was a very, very interesting experience for me. I work in a good institution. It's a private university. When I was there, we achieved AACSB accreditation and AVIL accreditation. And once again, I learned a lot. Then I came to Bahrain, and I was very fortunate to work in Bahrain, and was there as president for 8 years and 2 months. And we had programs with British universities, with London South Bank University, and with Cardiff Met at some stage. And you can see a different, once again, culture and value system because of some of the influence of our colleagues from the UK. And I pushed for the QAA accreditation of the university, the International Quality Review, achieved it. And we did a lot at the Applied Science University, working with Chairman Professor Wahib Al-Khaja and the Vice President, Dr. Mohamed Youssef, and other colleagues in Bahrain. And then I came to Abu Dhabi University almost a year and almost 2 months ago. And it's a university which is going places, I can assure you. It's accredited by WASC, Zoologic Center American System at Abu Dhabi University, Western Association of Zoological Colleges, accredited by the Commission for Academic Accreditation in the UAE. But most importantly, the Business College is accredited by AACSB and EQUIS. Double accreditation for a university in the Middle East. 1% of business schools across the globe have double accreditation. Accredited for SNG programs by ABIT. For our architecture, we're accredited by RIBA Part 1. For the health programs, the APHEA, which is a European accreditation. And when you see the achievements and rankings as well, where we are in the top 300 in the Times Higher Education World University ranking, we are number 9th in the Arab world and the Arab region rankings. And when you look at the number of universities, 33,000 universities across the globe, maybe 1,200 universities in the Arab region. We were ranked 59th in Asia ranking. There are 13,300 universities in Asia. For a university which is 20 years old, in addition to the QS 5 stars and the QS ranking in the MBA program, we are in the top 200. It's 151-200. It's just a major achievement for a young university, 20 years old, but it's because of the combination of factors. Of course, the great support from the top, the board of directors and Dr. Ali Dahiri, but our colleagues who work really, really hard, our students who are our best ambassadors. We have 8,000 students, 28,000 alumni who are in really top positions, and those are the best ambassadors of the university. So when you take everything together and you see we are working in a truly cosmopolitan international environment. You have 43 nationalities among faculty and staff. So wherever I go, I hear different languages being spoken and students from over 101 nationalities working together, studying together in harmony, respect for each other. It shows the value system of the university, which is the reality is the value system of the UAE, Abu Dhabi and the UAE as a whole, Dubai and the rest. As you enter the airport, you can smell innovation. You can feel it. You can touch it from the moment you enter the airport. And you come here and everything is based around really being part of the competition. We want to be the best. So the culture is created in the university, which is really, really nice, in fact, to have it amongst our staff, faculty, students, alumni, our partners, we establish a lot of partnerships with so many institutions from across the world. And institutions are in the top 200. And I don't think those institutions would have come to us to partner with us because they're worried about the reputation. I mean, we recently, when I was in the UK, we signed two MOUs with Loughborough University and Lancaster University. And as you know, those are top universities in the UK. So, and before we signed with University of Technology Sydney, in fact, in Australia, and so many universities from across the globe. But these are just examples. So I think it's important to understand the value system, learn from what you have. I've been very, very lucky because I learned a lot from the UK and I brought it to the region. So I combine now almost my own value system, which comes Lebanon, from the Arab region, with the nice values, nice things I learned from the UK, and you put them in an institution. Recently, we hosted at our Lyon campus the Times Higher Education Reputation Forum. We had about maybe 200 people from 80 nations, from 75 institutions from the region and beyond. And we were ranked in the top 101, 200, and 125 in the world university ranking by the Times Higher for reputation. And you can see the place was full of people from across the globe, working together, presenting to each other, enjoying the moment, and so on. And that's what we should be doing in academia in order to help our students understand that the world has become smaller. Technology is playing a major role in making us smaller. And COVID-19, of course, played a major role in terms of doing what we're doing today, using Zoom. Maybe before COVID, we may have thought maybe we should meet physically somewhere and fly 14 hours to Australia to perform this podcast. So the world has changed, and I think, but it's so important for us to learn from each other's value system. And I hope, Martin, soon in this podcast, to host HEDX in Abu Dhabi. And you will see, you will be exposed to a culture where you will enjoy because you come from this culture of innovation and creativity and great ideas, and would be absolutely delighted to show you our achievement in the UAE and the region and our value system, which is absolutely spot on in order to achieve really well. When you are driven by excellence and quality, you can do a lot.
Well, thank you very much for that very kind invitation, Ghassan. I've spent many years being completely unable to resist your generous invitation. So I'm probably going to find it very hard to resist that one. But just as a bit of a distraction before I go on with some questions, your title is Chancellor of Abu Dhabi University. Now, the title Chancellor means different things in different places. I noticed a few recent appointments of new chancellors in the UK, and they're quite often, you know, completely non-academic related, you know, symbolic figures. In Australia, chancellor positions are very much governance positions, and they're very detached from the management responsibilities. I get a sense that your role is an awful lot more involved with, probably much more full-time. I'm pleased to hear that you're not working all night anymore. But what's the role of Chancellor at Abu Dhabi University like for those listening to this podcast in other parts of the world?
It's interesting, this title in academia, because we love to just confuse people. A Chancellor is the Chief Executive Officer of a university, exactly like a Vice Chancellor in the UK or President of a university. When you look at the terminology now, so you have Chancellor in this region, which means President of the University. In other parts, it's an honorary role. So this is my full-time job. I run the university on a daily basis. This is what a Vice-Chancellor would do. Of course, when you look at the titles, it's similar to President, Principal, Rector, Chancellor. So many titles, and it's very, very confusing, you find. But really, no, my role is just, I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the university. I run the university on a daily basis. I'm responsible for the management of the university. We have the board of directors by Dr. Ali Al-Dahiri, who are the governing body for us. And of course, if there was no separation between management and governance, we won't be able to achieve the WASC accreditation and the ACSB and the EQUIS and the rest. So as a university managed properly, as it happened, the title is chancellor, which is the equivalent of a president to a large extent, but I'm responsible for the management, the daily running of the university.
I thought you were the boss, and you're the boss, aren't you?
Yeah, I am, but there is a boss on. There's always a top boss on top of you, and I have a fantastic boss, right? Dr. Ali Al-Dahiri. We're working together. Look, I think a key to the success of any university, if the president or chancellor or vice chancellor or whatever cannot work closely with the chair of the governing body, you will not be able to survive. Because if you have different visions, different directions, etc., that doesn't work at all. We are all in the same boat. Some people are governing us, making sure that we are delivering, they're looking at our KPIs, but they are letting us running the business on a daily basis. We do it ourselves.
One of the challenges for leaders, whether it's in governing roles or in leadership roles in places like Australia, I think places like the US and probably to a significant extent places like the UK at the moment, is to, and we've been focusing a lot on headaches, has been to address the goal of bringing more equity and access to opportunity in higher education to more people that can gain from it. And taking steps to try and innovate the business model and use technology to achieve that. Now, you and I spent 10 years working together, trying to use technology to change models of working in industry together in the civil engineering and construction industry. And now you're running a university. How you're running a university in the UAE, in a part of the world that you say just smells of innovation. How much is a change agenda, new learning technology, and aiming to increase access to higher education in the UAE and to students from other parts of the world? How important is that to you and your colleagues at ADU?
Of course, access. We are a private university and we are for profit university, but providing access to financial aid and support our students is vital. It's embedded in the value system of the institution of the governing board. And in general, in the UAE, people are very, very generous when it comes to donations and scholarships and the rest. I can tell you in the last 20 years, we spent 280 million dirhams, around $80 million, just on scholarships to support students who are in need of financial aid. Of course, access through technology now would play a role as well. I think things are changing where people are moving more towards the hybrid approach, where some modules could be run in hybrid mode, which maybe give people access if they are working, may lead to a cheaper financial model. So the running costs would become less if certain elements are done online. But access is just is important. I think everyone should have access to, banks in the UAE were arranging with banks to give loans to students and see how they can pay back, similar to what happened in the UK, Martin, when we were there, and the rest of the world. But of course, there's financial pressure now across the globe. And people will need to be creative and innovative in terms of funding education and higher education.
Yes, and innovation comes in many forms, doesn't it? I know that one... Because I can not seem to access LinkedIn at the moment without finding you on the front page of it every time I turn it on. I know when people like Michael Crowe are turning up in Abu Dhabi University. I know he's been a particular innovator with technology to try and meet some of those equity goals. And you're probably aware that he's just signed this new strategic partnership with OpenAI. So I want to use that as a segue to talk more specifically about AI as the latest example of such a new technology. And ask you, because I know you have thought much about this, how you're seeing AI will change the world of work
and is changing the world of learning at ADU. What have been the attitudes within that vision that you will have developed? What have been the attitudes that you and other regional universities take to the opportunities that technology provides, compared with what and how you need to provide safeguards that need to be applied to its use? How do you stand on the broad AI issue?
A very good question, Martin, of course, and this is the future, no question about it. It's with us and we have to accept it. Now, I should have mentioned when you spoke about access. Access to students and access to community is very, very important in terms of innovation. I can tell you one thing. We have an initiative here. It's called Invest in Our Community. It's run by our Vice Chancellor, who's like Deputy Chancellor. We don't confuse the Vice Chancellor role once again, Dr. Hamad Odabi. We run weekly lectures online to the community at large. I did two. One on art and science of leadership, attended by over 600 people, maybe from across the globe. I did another one last week on how to succeed in doing a PhD to support PhD community at large across the globe. And we had around 500 people attending. We run lectures on teaching and learning, on innovation and research, and technology development and the rest by my colleagues every week. This is every Thursday at 9 p.m. UAE time. But Dr. Hamad as well on Sunday evening, he runs lectures on AI and ChatGPT and the rest, which was, I attended one last Sunday. It was just amazing. He was showing us how to create a video to do some teaching for his subject. He teaches one subject too. How to look at the learning outcomes, how to produce some really nice AI videos. And it was about object-oriented programming, the subject. It was amazing how AI could be used to transform the way we deliver our lectures, the way we design our curriculum. And it was done in such a funny way that I thought it was really easy for me at this age to understand what Dr. Hamad was talking about. So AI, for sure, it's a priority for the university, it's a priority now for every single institution. And AI has been around, as you know, Martin, for 70 years. It's become fashionable now because of ChatGPT and the rest. And ChatGPT is a fantastic development. It's good for us. It's like doing search on Google, but you're doing search on ChatGPT now, where it will collect all the information for you and you can synthesize it, analyze it. And take what's really important for you. So in terms of contribution to our students, there's no question it would help them. Imagine when we did our PhDs to do our literature review, and how many times we have been to the library, and how many times we have used library loans to get the books or the article, and now you can go and ask ChatGPT to perform at least an initial literature review for you. To tell you, these are the main references. Then you can go and access them online. You don't need to go to the library. If you want to go to the library, it's really nice. But the whole model has changed in terms of using technology. And AI, without any doubt, will transform our lives in the future. Like whatever has happened in the past, it's not just AI. If you look at communication, I remember when I was in the UK, if I wanted to phone my family, I have to go to the red box. Do you remember this, the telephone, the red box? And this was our favorite, to be able to phone our family in Lebanon, to speak to the neighbor, and they would call somebody from the family to come down. And now you have a mobile phone, and who knows, the next generation may look back and then say, oh my God, those people were using mobile phones, because the phone could be chips embedded in your body. So everything is changing so fast. Technology is playing a major role in terms of delivery and the rest. And AI will play a major role. You know, Martin, I have always looked at the John Kotter, a change management model. And step one was establish the sense of urgency. I couldn't understand it, to be honest, all my life, maybe. Until COVID came along, and I was in Bahrain. In the past, we wanted to run some online courses, so we asked our regulatory body to run them online. They said, no, it's much better to get the students, etc. When COVID came along, the regulatory body was phoning us to say, please, we have to run the whole university online, because our students were... So things have changed overnight. This is a sense of urgency. The whole nation will be without education, all kids without. No, we have to do something about it. And the same here, once you have the sense of urgency for changing the business model, and AI could play a major role in that, then you have no choice. You will be behind. And I look at it in a very, very positive way. In our university, we have introduced all the guidelines to faculty and students on the use of ChatGPT or generative AI, whatever, in order to help them understand the ethical issues. And to be honest, Martin, it's not different from asking somebody to write your PhD thesis or write a report for you or whatever, if you are unethical. So if you are unethical, you can go to ChatGPT and get the information that they are. If you are an ethical person, and alhamdulillah, the majority of people, majority of students are ethical, they understand ethics. So it should be seen as an aid for us to help us focus on some other opportunity.
Well, thanks for that very sound and wise and grounded view of the exciting and fast-changing world of technology. And look, just moving, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you again, Ghassan, and you've been exactly how I thought you'd be, which is so humble and generous, but also so thoughtful and wise and innovative. And I just wonder, in closing, You've now worked in universities all around the world, but you remain like a fresh brain committed to innovation and technology. And I wonder what now that combination of experience and commitment to innovation lead you to see as a future for our universities around the world over, I don't know, the next maybe 10 years or more. And in closing, are you optimistic about how higher education is changing for good?
I am always optimistic. When we see the main driving forces these days and what needs to be done in areas like health, the climate change, peace and security, and financial services, and so on. So you will need to do research of applied nature. If you look at the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and we know that we're not going to meet the target by 2030, we have to do more work in these areas. If you look around you and see what's happening across the globe, 2 billion people across the globe don't have access to clean water. 250 million kids don't go to school. Some nations waste 200 kilograms of food every year. Some nations consume 600 liters of water per capita per day. We need research and innovation. We need to do research which can help find solutions to these problems. I think so important for us. It's really important for us to be, not to be in ivory towers, take away from reality. We should use innovation to embrace a culture of excellence and of achievements, of finding solutions. In our university, we have 25 patents from our research. Once again, for a university which is 20 years old, to be able to produce 25 patents in about 20 years, it's a major achievement for us. So we are taking research into the commercialization stage. And research through innovation, as you know, Martin, from our work in Salford even, there's a big difference between invention and innovation. When you invent something to take it into the like commercialization stage, if you look at the color TV, it took 5 years to go from the creation phase to the use phase. So we have to be patient in terms of making sure that we are innovating in our practices, whether at research level, the teaching level, or enterprise community engagement level. But without innovation, of course, you won't be able to survive. Innovation, once again, should be the oxygen. We breathe, we feel, we touch. And most universities now have like innovation centers or technology park, innovation park. We have an innovation center in the university here, in order to encourage our students to go into the incubation stage of their businesses or ideas, in order to create an environment of innovation and creativity. And these are really important for us. It's really important for us to work together globally, because the world has become a small global village. We were talking about global village in the past, and now we know technology. You can see what happened today with this podcast. We can do the same, we can do research, of similar nature. We can help the world resolve some of the fundamental problems. And that's why I refer to the sustainability issues, and where we have to work hard to find solutions, to find clean water for nations who are struggling in that area, or having access to schools. You told me about access to universities. Imagine those 250 million people every day, kids do not go to school. Disastrous for us, unless we have to. So we have no choice but to help them and find a solution. And I think this would be the essence of being in higher education. Our job is to find solutions, help people. And this is the satisfaction we get from the job. The job is hard, but the satisfaction is when you see your students graduating, when you solve problems for deprived nations or whatever. I think it's really important.
Well, it's obviously something that you grew up with, that you mastered at an early age, that you've put to such great purpose through a career that reached such great heights in Europe, and now you're continuing to live by and thrive by in different parts of the UAE and the Middle East, Ghassan. And for being our guest on the HEDX podcast today and giving us such wise words about cultural intelligence as one of a number of important intelligences, and how it combined with innovation and technology can lead to even the youngest of universities to make major impacts on the global stage.
The secret of success when you are in this position, because you tend to travel a lot, etc., and you are on the road, is to have a decent office. You need a decent office director. I'm very lucky. I have Khulood here, Linda, and the rest. They are really nice. But this is what happened when I was in Salford, at University of Hong Kong, Dubai, in Kuwait, in Bahrain, and now in Abu Dhabi universities. Having this team which can help you would make a very big difference.
It's so like you to end the podcast by being so generous to the people that go out of their way to make your day more effective, Ghassan. You haven't changed a bit. Thank you so much for joining the HEDX podcast.
Well, it's my pleasure talking to you. See you soon. See you in Abu Dhabi. Yeah?
Well, there we go, Christy. That was an old friend of mine and an old colleague in Ghassan Awad, the Chancellor of Abu Dhabi University. What are the different things that you took from that interview?
Well, two things really stood out for me, Martin. The first is hearing Ghassan's vision of a university. So it's always really interesting to hear from very senior university leaders who have a lot of experience, to hear what their vision of the university is. It's abstract, but it's also a really powerful thing to hear, because it's how they drive their institutions. So Ghassan's vision of the university is very, very similar to that expressed by another guest to the HEDX podcast, Ant Bagshaw, in his Higher Imagination. And like Bagshaw, Ghassan envisages higher education as a platform for social good, as a driver of social positivity. He really has that as a strong vision at the heart of his work. And I think that's particularly interesting to hear how he's carried that vision through. The second part of the interview that I think is a really productive complement to that is the ingredients to the recipe of what makes a successful university. And this is where I think it gets particularly interesting. We could listen to that podcast as a fairly conventional narrative. He climbed the career ladder, and now he's running universities. He knows all his metrics very well, and his rankings and how many patents they've generated. So in some ways, you could say this sounds like a reasonably conventional narrative of a successful career and positive universities. But where it diverges from what we might think of conventional is where Ghassan talks about what he thinks are the real key constituents of a successful university and university culture. And it's not just the rankings and the patents, with which he's also very conversant. I think what really stood out for me is his identification of the United Arab Emirates cultural diversity as a key driver of the success of his institution. Ghassan says to us that the cultural tolerance and mutual respect in UAE is much stronger than in the West. And he finds that makes a really productive operating environment for a successful university. Similarly, he talks about intelligence as being a key driver of a successful university, but not your IQ. He talked about emotional intelligence, cultural intelligence, and social intelligence as real core drivers of his very successful university. So for me, that was particularly interesting, was to hear some of those specifically UAE cultural constituents, but also some of those other sort of what we might think of soft constituents of a successful university. Finally, I just thought it was really interesting, as we were saying at the beginning, to hear about higher education in a different cultural context.
Well, it is, isn't it? It sometimes you have to see things that are very different from those that you're familiar with to draw out the issues and the lessons that are more difficult to learn at home, where the complexity is more nuanced. And because all of those things that you just said about what Ghassan is dealing with so successfully in a UAE context are no different in some ways to what a leader of a British, an American, or an Australian university right now, a leader of one of those institutions is having to deal with, given the complexities in our world, the increased diversity that all of us are both dealing with and seeking to celebrate and take advantage of. And I think you've also drawn attention to the fact that increasingly university leaders and practitioners from places like the UK, Europe, North America, and Australia, New Zealand may find themselves working in a transnational education sense in places like those that Ghassan's operating in. So, yeah, some really thoughtful and thought-provoking challenges to the concept of intelligence, demonstrated by someone that's got quite a good handle on those variety of intelligence in an academic setting. Well, was there anything else there that jogs your mind and your thoughts as we embrace the sort of, you know, here we are now with the accord behind us and the world of doing something about it all in front of us? We're all, as leaders, going to need to be able to deal with, if we ever thought we'd get all the answers to all of the certainty out of one bit of policy report, I think it's undoubtedly the case that that hasn't arisen. We're left with probably more questions than answers. And that ability to navigate complexity and nuance is going to be really important in the period ahead for everybody, isn't it?
I agree. And I think as we begin to navigate the complexities of our own post-accord future, it is, again, very productive to look at the navigations of others who are navigating different regulatory and cultural settings, but still on the same mission as many of us, which is making higher education work. So for a post-accord audience, I think listening to Ghassan's podcast is really useful because he is dealing with some of the issues the accord will throw up, like extreme diversity. I would love to know more from Ghassan about how this extreme diversity actually works in practice. It sounds wonderful. They've got students from over 100 nationalities at Abu Dhabi University. There's only 8,000 students in the full cohort. So this is really significant diversity, staff from over 40 nationalities. I want to know how that works. I would really like to hear how that mutual tolerance and respect works so that possibly we could begin to leverage some of those lessons for our own context.
Christy, you've done a lovely job for me there, because I'm going to be doing a live cross with Ghassan on the 21st of March from the Melbourne Museum. I hope, well, I know you'll be there with me, and I know many of our listeners are looking forward to joining us. We're looking at like a sellout event at this stage, which is very exciting. And you've probably just given me some really good lines of questioning to follow up this conversation to date with Ghassan Awad as we continue to explore the full range of diversity issues in bringing about change in higher education.
Indeed. So I encourage all listeners to head off to the HEDX conference on March 21st, where you can actually talk with Ghassan directly via live stream, ask him some of the questions that occur to you as you listen to today's podcast.
Well, that's a lovely note to finish on, Christy. Thank you very much for joining us as a co-host. We look forward to seeing you at the conference and with more guests to talk to and to talk about on the HEDX podcast in episodes to come.
Martin, I can't wait.
And that's all we've got time for this week on HEDX.